Afternoon, and welcome to the Senate Committee on Environment and Natural Resources for February 17, 2011. First, we are going to open up a work session for the possible introduction of committee members. Beth?
Members, there are four LCs in front of you that have been, people have asked to have introduced as committee bills. I won't go over them.
Okay. So I will accept a motion. We can do one motion for all of these, correct?
Nay.
Oh, yes. And I just, why don't you go ahead and make the motion, and I won't make that.
Chair Dingfelder, I move the following LCs be introduced as committee bills. LC 1900, dated 2-1-11. LC 2507, dated 11-19-10. LC 3394, dated 2-11-11. And LC 3395, dated 2-7-11.
Okay, Senator Olson moves that the following LCs be introduced as committee bills. And committee members, just a reminder that these bills are being introduced for discussion purposes only. If you vote aye, that does not necessarily mean that you're voting yes on the content of the bill. It's just for introduction as committee bills. So with that, as I mentioned, Senator Olson moved LC 1900, dated 2-1-2011, LC 2507, dated 11-19-2010, LC 3394, dated 2-11-2011, LC 3395, dated 2-7-2011. Is there any discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, the measures are introduced as committee bills. And with that, we will close the work session. I think that's it for introduction of committee measures for this session.
Except
for priority bills. I'm sure you'll be relieved about that. And then we are going to reopen the public hearing on Senate Bill 529. And this was carried over from our 2-15-11 agenda. We have the sheets of folks who didn't get a chance to testify. And I'm going to call up Ralph Groner, Betsy Earls, and Holly Sear.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Welcome back. Sorry about the carrying over, so we appreciate you coming back.
Yeah, I'm up on a budget down the hall, so I've got to speak fast. I'm Ralph Groner, representing AskMe, my green AskMe Green Caucus, AskMe DEQ, AskMe Metro, the worker bees. Members of AskMe, and this was written by Leslie Cochin, not me, one of my members out of DEQ. Members of AskMe Council 75 support passage of Senate Bill 529, the continued and increasing use of energy-efficient lighting support. Supports the goals of our members who work in the environmental field and saves our members money. However, due to the dangers of releasing mercury into the environment, this type of lighting belongs under a product stewardship program. Fluorescent lighting is 75% more energy efficient than incandescent lighting, reducing climate change emissions and supporting the climate change work that many of our members are engaged in with local and state governments. A safe and convenient collection program, combined with a limit on the amount of mercury in lighting, will prevent releases of mercury into our air, water, and soil, thus supporting local and state government toxic reduction programs. A safe and convenient collection system will protect our members' families and the broader Oregon community, as well as workers in the waste management system. Increased use of fluorescent lighting is more economically efficient for our members as well as the government, I want to emphasize government facilities, that house local and state employees and infrastructure, but must go hand in hand with a safe collection system. Our members at DEQ, Metro, and we represent most cities and counties workers in Oregon, around the state already have a track record of collaborating to develop and implement product stewardship programs. Examples, eCycles program, which we supported, for electronics and PaintSmart. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, for your taking the time to listen.
Great. Thank you, Ralph. And I know you have to run off for another hearing, so thank you. Holly.
Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee,
For the record, my name is Holly Sears, and I'm the Governmental Affairs Director for the Oregon Refuse and Recycling Association. We're a trade association representing private solid waste and recycling companies here in Oregon. During the interim, ORA developed its own product stewardship subcommittee, and it was comprised of a geographically diverse group of members from our association, made up of both large and small garbage and recycling companies. And the purpose of the committee was to have an in-depth discussion about product stewardship and to develop a set of principles on product stewardship. And as a result, we came up with 7 product stewardship principles that relate mostly to the collection aspect of product stewardship, because that is our area of expertise. So I'm just going to briefly tell you what those principles are. The first one is that public safety and protection of the environment must have priority over all other aspects of a product stewardship program. We also feel that manufacturers and producers shall fully fund a basic depot collection system for product stewardship programs, but that local governments should retain the authority to make local decisions regarding their product stewardship collection mechanisms. So if they want to go beyond that and establish a curbside or an event program, that would be more of a bells and whistles approach, and that would be paid for through their rates. And with that, we believe that manufacturers and producers could cut costs for their programs by using the existing infrastructure that's currently out there in Oregon to establish their collection network. We also feel that the convenience standards for collection sites should be defined more than just by distance to users, but also the public safety and protection of the environment, as well as the opportunity to recycle more than one item at a location, as well as economic feasibility and sustainability. Number 6 is collection sites should be required to register with the DEQ, inform them of what their operations plan is and their site closure plan, to have that in place, and that DEQ should regulate that depot collection system and review it to make sure that it's meeting the goals of the product stewardship program. So we're discussing amendments with DEQ and Metro that reflect these principles that ORA has developed. However, our members feel very strongly that there are 2 product stewardship programs that are currently in Oregon, the e-waste and the paint product stewardship program, that should be refined and reviewed and corrected as needed before we add another product stewardship program to that list. We believe that any product stewardship program should be established to serve the best interests of all Oregonians by establishing environmentally safe programs and with proper oversight at all levels that are convenient to both rural and urban communities here in Oregon. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Betsy?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Betsy Earls, representing Associated Oregon Industries and the AOI Retail Council. My comments today are directed mainly out of the product stewardship program portion of this bill. AOI and its retailers are supportive of the pieces of the bill that have to do with mercury content standards and state procurement policy. But now that we've got that out of the way. Members of the AOI Retail Council have a strong interest in the responsible stewardship of the products that they sell. This stewardship encompasses activities such as consumer education, providing return facilities for certain products, and making sustainable choices of what products to offer. Several of our members offer house brands of certain products. These products are generally priced lower than name brands, and it can be anywhere from a few cents to a few dollars. Because these members would be defined as producers in some instances under Senate Bill 529, they would be compelled to participate in the product stewardship programs that are set up under the bill. The program adds some cost to the products that are regulated due to the cost markups that will occur along the supply chain. Increasing the cost of CFLs will make them less appealing to consumers, and we've shown that consumers are very, very price sensitive in terms of technology like this, and especially the budget-conscious demographic that is targeted by the lower-cost house brands that our members sell. This impact is contrary to the basic purpose of the manufacturing and selling of CFLs, which is to reduce overall energy consumption by using them to replace less efficient bulbs. To turn on their lights, Oregonians use a mix of power sources that includes about 40% coal. Coal-fired power plants are the largest source of mercury contamination in this country, and it doesn't make sense to us to disincentivize the use of CFLs to reclaim some mercury when using a cheaper and less efficient bulb draws so much more heavily on that largest source of mercury contamination, which is coal-fired power plants. And that's my testimony.
Okay. Okay. Thank you. Questions?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Senator?
Ms. Earls, you had mentioned there would be a cost markup in the supply chain. That would that start at first the cost of the manufacturer for the recycling, secondly at the recycle station due to DEQ regulations because they would be permitted? Do you know how much or have an idea how much this would add to the cost of a CFL?
Senator Olson, I'm sorry, I have not any idea. I would be happy to try and find out.
Would you agree with me that there will be a significant markup because of the extra cost of this?
I do agree with you, Senator Olson, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Olson, you say significant. Can you define that for us? Because I heard in your testimony it sounded like it could be pennies to dollars, depending on what the product is. Could you be a little bit more specific?
Sure. Madam Chair and Senator Prozanski, when I was being asked about a significant price increase, my thought, instead of trying to pin that down, was more that when you have budget-conscious consumers that are looking for a cheaper or more cost-effective item, they can feel like a price increase of 10 or 20 cents is significant to them. So I guess what I would say to you is that in terms of the consumer's perspective, it could be a significant price increase, even though 10 or 20 cents, you know, may not break the bank in terms of the whole product sale.
So if I can follow up. So I'm just assuming, what I assume then is it's based on the subjectivity of whoever that consumer is as to whether it's significant enough for them to go away from that product, valuing whatever the length of the item, such as these type of lights, seem to have maybe a lifespan of five times, six times more from at least the advertisements that are on the side of the boxes.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair and Senator Prozanski, I would agree with that, but we also see in our stores that in the moment people, I mean, I don't know exactly what's in their heads, but they do tend toward the lowest cost item, and I don't know if they're thinking about the 5 years they're going to get out of the light bulb or not.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay. Thank you both. Susan Clark, Brent Stevenson, and Andrea Salinas. Is Susan here from Marion County?
No.
Okay. Brent? No. So Andrea. Okay. So we'll keep calling folks. Emily? We'll keep going down the list. Whoever answers can come up. It looks like a Lewis.
I think that's not
it. Okay. And then have Peggy Lynch. Is Peggy here? You want to come up? And then we just have Jeff Bissonnette after that and see if anybody else is. So, Andrea, if you want to get started?
Sure.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Andrea Salinas. I'm the Legislative Director for the Oregon Environmental Council. OEC supports SB 529 to establish a product stewardship program for fluorescent mercury lighting in Oregon. OEC supports the use of CFLs as a low-cost way to conserve energy and reduce greenhouse gases. But equally important is the disposal of these lights due to the harmful mercury included in the product. OEC has been working to reduce mercury contamination in Oregon for over 10 years as part of our Children's Environmental Health Program work. OEC has been working with stakeholder groups such as the Oregon Mercury Solution and the Coalition to support passage of the Mercury Reduction Act of 2001 in Oregon. And as Senator Dingfelder mentioned on Tuesday, this includes reductions in mercury in thermostats, barometers, and the like. As you know, mercury is a highly toxic neurotoxin with severe negative impacts on children, and this is the area where OEC has really been focusing. Children become exposed through fish consumption, infants through their mother's breast milk, and fetal development through their mother's contamination. The harmful effects include lower IQ, damage to the central nervous system, hearing impairment, and poor coordination. More recent studies have implicated mercury in preterm birth. As mentioned in previous testimony, mercury persists for decades, and it moves up the food chain. So by the time we eat it, the contaminated fish, the concentrations are very high. And to give some kind of like real-life perspective, it only takes about a gram of mercury, about the amount found in one thermometer or automotive light switch, to contaminate a 20-acre lake. So the fish are unsafe to eat. Oregon currently has fish consumption advisories for mercury on 13 water bodies, warning pregnant women and young children not to eat certain fish, including the entire main stem of the Willamette River. OEC firmly believes SB 529 is consistent with the discussions of the 2010 Product Stewardship Stakeholder Group convened by the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality, on which OEC participated. We would strongly encourage your support of SB 529. Thank you.
Thank you. Emily?
Good afternoon, Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee. My name is Emily Ackland. I'm the Environmental Policy Manager with the Association of Oregon Counties. The Association of Oregon Counties supports product stewardship for lighting containing mercury. As you know, counties are responsible for solid waste programs. This includes being responsible for meeting state material recovery goals, ensuring safe and environmentally responsible management of hazardous materials, as well as providing education encouraging the three R's, reducing, reusing, and recycling. Counties have identified product stewardship principles, which you have in my written testimony. I will emphasize that counties strongly believe that education should be a primary focus of product stewardship programs, and counties believe that any product stewardship program should have a collection system that is convenient in both urban and rural areas. Counties have identified lighting containing mercury as a priority for product stewardship program in Oregon for two main reasons. Mercury is a hazardous substance, and because incandescent light bulbs are being replaced by compact fluorescent light bulbs, CFLs, at a high rate. For example, I was recently told that the Tillamook People's Utility District recently sent out 20,000 CFL bulbs to their customers complimentary. Most counties currently collect mercury lighting at their transfer stations, household hazardous waste facilities, and at household hazardous waste collection events. Although it varies by county, a rough average expenditure of the programs ranges between $20,000 and $40,000 annually. This amount is likely to go up due to an increase in demand by consumers. Counties are also responsible for pollution that comes out of landfills, both as stormwater runoff and as leachate. That's the water that trickles through landfill material and collects contaminants. Preventing mercury from entering leachate is a concern for counties and one that could be addressed by keeping mercury-containing lighting out of landfills. Counties support a product stewardship program in Oregon for lighting-containing mercury. We welcome the opportunity to work with partners and stakeholders to develop a program that addresses the need to remove mercury from the environment, educates consumers, and provides equal opportunity to properly dispose lighting in urban and rural parts of the state. Thank you for the opportunity.
Great. Thank you. Peggy.
Peggy Lynch, League of Women Voters of Oregon. The League of Women Voters is a nonpartisan grassroots political organization that encourages informed and active participation in government. The League supports policies to reduce solid and hazardous waste. And rather than read the rest of my letter, I will provide you with a couple of comments heard from last week's hearing. We get it that consumers will have to pay a little bit more, but our members believe it's really important, and that's why we supported the paint recycling program last session. You have heard all of the scientific evidence related to the concerns about mercury. And Oregonians have an appetite for recycling, as evidenced by the success of the eCycle program. The other comment I wanted to make was a concern, and it was good to hear Association of Oregon Counties say it's really important that we have collection sites in our rural areas too, even though there are lower populations. That's where our waters begin, all of our waters that we drink, and so it's really important that they not be contaminated, even though I know it will be much more of a challenge to be able to make sure that we have adequate collection sites in rural areas. So we appreciate this opportunity to express the League's longstanding support for product stewardship legislation, and we ask that you send Senate Bill 529 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for the panel?
Yes,
Senator Olson.
Ms. Auckland, do you know how many hazardous waste sites are in each county?
As far as collection facilities go,
yes.
I don't know the number off the top of my head. It would vary by county. Some have household hazardous waste facilities. That would be less than 10, I believe. But that I can do some research on that and follow up.
For example, like Bend and Prineville, would Bend have its own hazardous waste collection site and Prineville have its own?
I think, Madam Chair and members of the committee, Senator Olson, I don't think they have them per city. It would be more one per county. And I can check with DEQ and get back to you on that.
It varies according to county, pretty much. And, of course, in the metro area, it's different.
One follow-up.
Yep.
Final follow-up. The point I'm getting to is consumers are a fickle lot. And if it's not convenient, they probably won't use it. And, you know, I don't want anyone to take the wrong measure here, that I want mercury out of the landfills. When we got into the CFL situation years ago to require houses to have this, we probably should have thought of this problem then, that there would be a problem coming up. But we're at it now. And the point being is that we have to make it convenient for people to get it there, because a question or a comment I made to another lady earlier was, would I pick up one light bulb and drive to Oregon City and stand in line or sit in line to distribute that one light bulb to the hazardous waste? We have to make it easy for them, and perhaps we can come up with an idea to do that.
Thank you. And I have a follow-up question for you, Emily, regarding the cost, because we heard about a concern from the industry about cost to consumers. The cost that you cite here, $20,000 to $40,000 annually, should I assume that's paid through property tax if the county is picking up those costs? It's got to be paid by somebody. So if it's a cost to the county, is that being passed on to constituents who are paying that?
Chair Dingfelder, I believe the costs would be paid for by the residents of the county. So. Yeah, I can follow up with you again and see how it works per county. It may be different.
All right, thank you. That would be helpful if you could follow up with that information. It appears that consumers in Oregon are already paying that cost. It's just being paid in a different way. Any other questions for this panel? Okay, thank you. I think we have one more person that wanted to testify. And is there anybody else that would like to testify in Senate Bill 529? Okay, Sue, come on up. Before the gavel comes down. All right. Thanks for coming back, Jeff. Go ahead.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jeff Bissonnette, representing the Citizens Utility Board of Oregon. We represent residential ratepayers of regulated utilities in the state. And I just want to make a few general comments in support of the bill. We have been using CFLs for about the past decade as a key energy conservation mechanism for ratepayers. And here I'm talking particularly in the service territories of Portland General Electric and Pacific Power. About a decade ago, in the midst of the Western energy crisis, we were doing pretty much anything we could to help people reduce their usage, which had an overall helpful effect, but also helped keep rates low. And I still have bulbs that I put in my house at that time, and I respect the work of the industry that has been trying to reduce the amount of mercury in the products, but the bulbs that I put in that are still working and hopefully will continue to work for another couple of years probably have, I suspect, more mercury in them than the bulbs that I could go buy today. And so I'm in complete agreement with Senator Olson that it would have been a good time then to sort of figure out how we were going to deal with these products. We didn't, and so that's the hand we're dealt. I also agree with the senator in terms of making the ability for consumers to deal with these products after they burn out convenient, because that is the way to get it done. We've seen that in helping consumers buy renewable energy. If it's there and it's affordable, they will do it, and they will do it in very high numbers. And so, as always, the devil is in the details. If there are further discussions around Senate Bill 529 to figure out those details and basically help consumers do the right thing, both by using the bulbs and then disposing of them safely, we'd be happy to be involved in those discussions. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Sue?
Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, my name is Sue Marshall. I'm here today representing Willamette Riverkeeper. Mercury is a problem for the Willamette River. It's one of the pollutants for which the Willamette is listed as water quality limited. Without going into too much detail of the Clean Water Act, when there is a pollutant identified that limits water quality, total maximum daily loads are set. That gets translated into permitting both for industrial and municipalities. So mercury and other pollutants, once they're out in the environment, become more and more difficult to address and more costly, and the public does end up paying. The prospect of new sources of mercury coming into the water is disturbing to us, and as we can find these upstream solutions, as we think Senate Bill 525 presents, that would be the most cost-effective way to go. We're heartened that people are looking for energy efficiency avenues, but we don't want inadvertent consequences to harm water quality in the Willamette. Thank you very much.
Sorry about that. We're trying to quiet the party that's going on right outside our door. But thank you for your testimony. Any questions for either of them? Okay. Thank you. And then Palmer, I heard you had some quick response before we close this hearing on numbers for recycling.
For the record, my name is Palmer Mason. I'm with the Department of Environmental Quality. Yes, I think I can answer some of the questions. I think in particular Senator Olson had some questions about what it costs to recycle CFLs. Those costs, and these are numbers from Metro and from Lane County, who both have pretty active programs in the state right now. It's 25 to 30 cents per CFL. So the smaller bulbs that we all use in our houses and small businesses. And then if you're talking about the tubes, such as that are in this committee room, it's 5 cents a foot, and it frequently is up to like 20 cents a tube. So those are some numbers that may be useful to the committee.
Okay. Great. Thank you, Palmer. Appreciate it. Anybody else who would like to testify in this bill? Okay, seeing none, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 529, and I'll be working with my vice chair on that, and we'll be coming back with some new language. Okay, with that, we are now going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 296. Beth, could you provide an overview?
Madam Chair,
overview of the bill, please.
Members of the committee, Senate Bill 296 extends the minimum distance between private hunting preserves from 1/2 mile to 3 miles. The bill would allow closer proximity if the preserves are owned, leased, or managed by the same person. The exception applies only to the person holding the preserve license and is not transferable. There is no revenue impact, minimal fiscal impact, so no statement was issued and no subsequent referral.
Okay, thank you. And we have, I think, Senator Ferrioli, would you like to introduce your bill?
Madam Chairman, I'd like to hear the proponents.
Okay, so we have two people who have signed up. Is this right?
No, I think I'll sign up.
Okay. We have one person signed up, Charles Cates. Is that correct? Okay. Welcome, sir, and if you can state your name for the record, please.
Thank you, Chairman Dingfelder. Not exactly used to this particular thing, but nonetheless, my name is Charles Cates, Chuck Cates. I manage the Luckamute Valley Pheasants Hunting Preserve near Monmouth. My reason for being here, I'm not a member of the association who drafted the particular language that's in it. I happen to own and operate with my brother two hunting preserves, which are within 3 miles of each other, and are owned and operated by an LLC. I'm not opposed to what they're trying to do here. It's just that I don't like some of the language that's in it, which would tend to say, for instance, the same person. I'm not a lawyer, but I don't believe an LLC is a person. It's a company, limited liability company. So being owned and operated by that would somewhat restrict our capabilities to maintain that. So I have submitted some alternative language, which I think will work.
Do you want to clarify on that?
Yeah. Is the LLC operating both of the establishments?
That's correct. But the license, actually, one is licensed under my brother and one is licensed under me, okay. Senator Prezansky. So, you know, whether it goes with the person or whatever, we would like to simply have it say, or entity.
Well, I just want to, if I may follow up, we would check with the Legislative Council, but usually an LLC would be considered a person as a type of corporation. If both are operated by the LLC as compared to being licensed to one individual versus another, we'd have to get that clarification. And it may be family or some other type of means of capturing your desires.
And very well. Thank you very much, Senator Prezansky and Chairman Dingfelder. The other thing in this language which I had requested to add was a paragraph grandfathering those legally established hunting preserves within 1 mile or 1.5 mile.
And if you could just step back a minute, one of the things that I think would be helpful if you could explain to the committee, what is the problem that you're trying to solve here? Because we have new members that this is the first time they're hearing this bill. So it might be good for you to explain, you know, how this came to be in statute and why you're requesting the change.
Actually, I'm not requesting a change, but the association is, Chairman Dingfelder, and I just came to know this a short time ago, so I apologize for having to bring all this up in hearing rather than working it out with the association in advance. But nonetheless, what it is a short time ago, historically, it was changed from 3 miles to 1.5 mile for what reason, I don't know. We made under our application.
In my
committee. Yeah, who knows, but it was changed, and now they want to change it back, okay? The original legislation, the half mile, we processed ours underneath that, so we have two hunting preserves within 1 mile. This legislation here, as proposed, would not allow us to transfer one of those hunting preserves to someone else without transferring both of them.
But we
even though we created them lawfully under the law at the time.
Yeah.
And that's why I would request a grandfathering clause in it.
Do you want to clarify?
Yeah, there is a Section 2 of the bill does specify that the amendments that would be done as a result of this bill only apply to licenses that are issued after the effective date of the bill.
Very well. If I missed that, then I apologize.
No, that's fine. Okay.
And we do. Does everyone have a copy of this letter?
It was on the S drive. I didn't make
okay.
a copy.
So we have a copy. I just received a copy of the letter from the association that explains what the issue was. And so this is helpful. We'll make sure that everybody, it's on your S drive. We can circulate it around so you can take a look at it as well. Okay. Okay, any questions? Okay. Senator, do you want to add anything?
Thank you, ma'am. Thank you.
You can stay up there if you want.
Okay.
Just in case some other questions come up.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Senator Ted Ferrioli. I have also the letter from the Association of Oregon Hunting Preserves, and Madam Chair, with your permission, for those listening on the Internet who don't have access to the S drive.
Yeah, if you want to read it into the record, that would be great.
If you don't mind. This letter comes from President of the Association of Oregon Hunting Preserves, Jerry Russell, and I think it deals specifically with the background and answers the question that is before us. I'm writing on behalf of our association requesting the passage of Senate Bill 296. Our association approached Senator Ferrioli last year asking to have the distance between licensed hunting preserves mandated back to the original 3 miles unless the preserves that are closer than 3 air miles are operated by the same entity, i.e. corporation, LLC, partnership, or person. The reasons being very real concerns about the spread of disease, commingling of species, safety, congestion, and opposing management practices by different operations within the very close distance of only 1.5 mile. Senate Bill 296 is the solution to a problem that we were trying to fix several years ago when the original 3 mile buffer was reduced to 1.5 mile to accommodate operations that wanted to have multiple preserves that they were in control of. Unfortunately, some were worried about the verbiage of that the new law, and to make a long story short, We took the easy way out by just reducing the legal distance down to half a mile because it was as close as any of the operations were required at the time. The association believes that multiple license preserves should be allowed, even if continuous, but only if operated by the same management organization. Limited preserves that are run by different entities need to be at least 3 miles apart, as was originally deemed prudent and safe by Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife personnel and preserve operators at the time when licensing was first required by the state of Oregon. We feel that verbiage in this bill is sufficient to solidify and establish what we as an organization require to keep honest ethics, good animal husbandry, and to avoid conflicts associated with different management operations in such a sensitive business. Sincerely, Mr. Jerry Russell, President of the Oregon Hunting Preserve Association. So, Madam Chair and members of the committee, without adding really anything to the testimony that was prepared and presented on behalf of the Oregon Hunting Preserves Association, I'd urge a favorable consideration for the bill that reestablishes a 3-mile distance between preserves unless operated by the same management organization.
And we were hoping that the department would be here because I did want to ask them a question, but do you recall, or was it in here, when this was originally changed?
I do, Madam Chair, and I think the agency then was neutral on that bill, and I believe they'd be neutral on this bill.
Okay. All right. Any questions for either of these gentlemen?
No. I'll go for it.
I've never known you to be shy
before. Thank you, Madam Chair.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you, Madam
Chair. Okay, thank you. I do have somebody else who'd like to testify, George Dern. And anybody else that would like to testify on this bill? Oh, okay. Welcome, and if you can state your name for the record, please.
I'm George Dern, and my wife and I own and operate a hunting preserve here in the Willamette Valley. I'm here to, as in Jerry Russell's place, who is president of the Oregon Association of Hunting Preserves, he snowed in. So the crux of the matter on this bill is simply to save conflict, period. That's all it is.
Thanks.
Okay. Any questions? I do have the department here who I'm going to ask up and see if he wants to make any comment on that, but thank you for being here today in place of Mr. Russell. Thank you. You thought you could sneak away. Hey, Kurt.
Thank you, Chair Dingfelder. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kurt Melcher, Deputy Director of the Department of Fish and Wildlife. We don't have any prepared statement here today. We're neutral on the bill. Really, it's not a resource issue for us, not in terms of how we manage the program, nor in terms of fish and wildlife resources. So it's really a business issue, and we're comfortable whether it's half a mile or 3 miles. If you had any specific questions, I'd be happy to answer those.
Right. Any questions for the department? Senator Brzezinski?
Madam Chair, I don't know if this is for the department. I want to kind of just put this on the record. I know we have this scheduled for a public hearing and possible work session. There has been a concern raised by the first person giving testimony. I think we just need to clarify whatever his situation is would be covered and get it done if we're going to move it forward.
Right. Correct. Thank you for highlighting that. Any comments or questions for the agency? Okay, Beth will be following up with you to make sure we clarify that language. Thank you.
Yep.
Okay, with that, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 296, and we won't have a work session at this time because we want to figure out if the language needs some tweaking. And that's our last public hearing today. However, we do have an informational meeting. I've asked the director of the Marine Board to come and talk about the Marine Board audit. Senator Thompson and I have already had a brief version of this presentation because we sit on the Ways and Means Subcommittee for Natural Resources. But I wanted to ask the director to come up and talk a little bit about, if you wanted to provide a brief overview, too, because you haven't yet, I think, come in front of this committee about the Marine Board. And it looks like we also have a member of the board that's here as well. So with that, I'm going to open up an informational meeting on the Marine Board. Welcome, Director.
Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, for the record, Scott Bruin, Director of the Oregon State Marine Board. With me is Brian Carroll, one of our board members. We've been asked today to come and present to you on the change of director audit that occurred at the Oregon State Marine Board. I do have a PowerPoint that I can present, or if you just prefer to go through the slides that I provided, I can do that as well, Senator.
We could do the PowerPoint if it isn't too difficult. Do we have a laptop? Okay. And while she's setting that up, can you provide, even though a couple of us have heard this presentation, just a brief overview for folks about the Marine Board, your function, and just as a backup for the audit, because not everybody sits on the Ways and Means, and they probably need a refresher from last session.
Okay. Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, the Oregon State Marine Board is Oregon's boating agency. We are an agency that's funded by boaters to serve boaters. We receive funding from titling and registration of boats, all sailboats 12 feet and over, and all motorized boats are required to be registered in the state of Oregon. We also receive money from motor boat fuel tax and from federal grants that are received by the Marine Board. We do not receive any general fund money. The Marine Board, primary purpose, we have an administrative section that's required to carry out the rules of ORS 830, which is our governing statute. We also provide law enforcement, boating safety patrols through contracts with 31 county sheriff's offices and the Oregon State Police. And we also provide grants to counties, cities, ports, special districts to assist with boating access.
And I also want to note that this director has been on for how many months?
9 months.
Okay. And we have the former director that's sitting in the audience, actually, as well.
Yes, we do.
Okay. Why don't you get started, and then Sue will set this up as you go. And actually, why don't we have the member of the board introduce himself and maybe say a few words about the board? Yes.
Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, my name is Brian Carroll, and I was appointed to the Marine Board in June of 2009, I believe, or right around that time, and have served since that time. I believe I've made pretty much all of the meetings. I'm not sure if I may have missed one, but I've pretty much been present since that time at the board meetings quarterly, and was part of the transition between Director Don Hefner and Director Bruin, and was involved in the process, the hiring process, from the beginning with the governor's office. So while I have some background with some of the issues here, I don't have a lot of information before 2009, other than to say that I have worked in the state of Oregon in Parks and Recreation for 13 years and have worked with the Marine Board in that capacity as a stakeholder. And that's where my interest in how I became affiliated with the board and asked for appointment to the board. Through the audit process, I would say that we were very much kept aware as a board by the interim director, Randy Henry, and he communicated with us. In fact, as soon as he became interim director, he immediately started a weekly communication email with us to keep us abreast of what was going on, and had let the board know that the director's audit was going to be taking place, and that he had asked to have that expanded to make sure it covered the whole agency so that everything was looked at, since it had been a while since there had been an audit. So I was not really prepared to give you a specific presentation, but certainly I am available for questions and will do my best to answer those.
And just for just if you can remind the committee how many members are on the board, and you're appointed by the governor.
Correct. There, Chair Dingfelder's member of the committee. There are 5 members of the board, and we are appointed by the governor's office and serve at his pleasure. We meet quarterly and do have special meetings beyond that, depending on the issues. We are a rulemaking body as well, and as Director Bruin said, we are the voting agency for the state of Oregon, so the rulemaking we do mostly revolves around recreational river and lake access, water access throughout the state of Oregon.
And are there designated positions, or do you serve at large as far as representing certain industries or groups or park providers or...
No, we do serve at large, but there is, I believe, an attempt to try to bring representatives from the different boating communities, whether they be motorized, non-motorized, commercial entities, recreation entities, to get a flavor for the different boating communities around the state. I think that attempt is made.
Thank you. Okay, Director, I think we're set. And hopefully nobody will fall asleep since we lowered the lights. So. Why don't you go ahead?
And Chair Dingfelder, I also wanted to apologize on behalf of the chair of the board. After our discussion on Tuesday, I asked her if she would be able to be here and present, but she is selling her business and was unable to make it down today for this hearing.
Thank you.
So the Secretary of State's Audits Division conducted the change of directors audit between February 2010 and October of 2010. This was the first audit that the agency has had with for about 15 years. During the course of the working for this audit, the interim director, Randy Henry, requested the Secretary of State's office to conduct a more extensive audit so he could find out exactly what the status of the agency was and what concerns there might be. So I'd just like to go through what was put into the audit, the specific findings, and then what the recommendations were and what we are doing at the Marine Board to address those recommendations. The first issue that was brought up was under questionable expenditures. We have, we have a number of volunteers who assist with the Oregon State Marine Board in carrying out our mandatory education program. They save us tens of thousands of dollars a year by not having to have deputies provide that training. So we bring them in once a year for additional training to catch them up on the newest laws, as well as they have an award ceremony to recognize those that work hard, that put in extra time teaching for the Marine Board. This particular workshop was held at the Oregon Garden for 31 volunteers. At the meal for the award ceremony, spouses and children attended that meal. That is not allowed by state policy. If you're going to have spouses and children attend a meal like that, you do have to have them pay to attend those meals. The meal itself exceeded per diem by $576, and the lodging was in excess of per diem by $148. Oregon statute or law does allow the board to make exceptions to those policies, but there were no exceptions that were noted in the record when the Secretary of State's audited. There was a meeting held at Alessandro's Restaurant in Salem with the Recreational Boating and Fishing Foundation. The Oregon State Marine Board received a grant from that foundation to assist with bringing back boaters who had not re-registered their boats. The idea was to send additional mailers to boaters to try to get encourage them to get their boats registered. So we received a grant from them for that, and there was a meeting held at Alessandro's with the board and with staff from the Marine Board to go through what the grant entailed. And the cost of the dinner was $30 per person, which was in excess of the per diem in Salem. At a postseason Marine Law Enforcement Conference in 2009, at this conference, this is the one chance where we bring all of the Marine deputies and marine managers together, as well as a number of sheriffs, attend this conference as well. There's a gathering the night before that gives an opportunity for board members and sheriffs and marine deputies to engage with one another about the work that they do. We had a board member that attended that function, which usually runs into the evening, 8 or 9 or 10 o'clock. He stayed over rather than driving back the following morning for the board meeting. At that same conference, they spent $800 on flowers as a decoration for the tables at the awards banquet. That is not authorized use of state funds. And the plaques and giveaways that they gave to the officers at the awards ceremony exceeded what is allowed by the state by $454. The next area addresses contracting rules. 18 of 25 boats that were looked at did not follow the competitive process required by the state to purchase the boats. Those boats, of course, were in excess of $5,000, which requires a competitive bid process. There were four repairs of boats that exceeded $5,000, but there was not a competitive bid process for those repairs either. And there were some county contracts that were amended without the director's knowledge. The director needs to sign for those, and they were amended without his signature. There were also 9 boats and 8 trailers that were disposed of without following the state property guidance for disposal. They were used to pay for storage and some other expenses, some repair expenses, rather than going through the surplus process or another authorized process through the state. There was equipment returned back to the Marine Board from the county sheriff's offices, and that was not added back into the inventory of the Marine Board. There were 2 laptops that were on the agency inventory but were being held by individuals and should have been on the individual's inventory. During a period when we had one of our staff members out on maternity leave, the check stock and bank reconciliation duties were held by a single person. Those are required to be separated and be held by 2 different people so that you don't have the opportunity for someone to take advantage of being able to have the ability to use those checks and being able to reconcile them. The director did not review the checks that used his electronic signature. And there were 17 checks that had been voided, but those checks were not shown in the register as voided checks. There were a number of issues that came up regarding the SPOTS card, which is a small purchase card that we use for the state. The SPOTS coordinator and the approver can't not be the same person for similar reasons as I talked about before. There was no training held for staff who held the SPOTS card. There were SPOTS card holders that allowed others to use their card, which is not authorized under state policy. The purchase log for those that use a SPOTS card, that is the way that managers ensure that the SPOTS card is being used appropriately. And there were instances where the purchase log had not been signed by the manager to show that they were aware of the purchases that had occurred. Supporting documentation to support the purchases was not always available. The last item, board employees purchase food for board-sponsored events. We went back to Department of Administrative Services after this audit came out, and the intent of that rule is that you can use the SPOTS card to purchase food for events while in travel status. You just can't purchase food for yourself. So the actual expenditures under this were approved by DAS policy, and Department of Administrative Services is changing the rule to reflect that, so it's more clear for those that are using their cards. Under travel policies not always followed, some state employees have travel cards. A travel card is not a liability for the state. It's a personal liability like any other credit card that you have in your wallet. Some people choose to use travel cards because there are no benefits received from them. There's no airline miles or anything like that, which would be a violation of state policy to use those cards for official business. So some people choose to obtain a state travel card. One employee used his travel card for some purchases at Rite Aid and for gasoline. Once again, those are purchases they're required to pay back. They're not paid by the state. However, it is a violation of state policy. There were two occasions where an individual was reimbursed for meals without receipts. They had attended a Coast Guard Auxiliary Conference in Portland and an International Association of Marine Investigators Conference in Portland and did not provide receipts for the meals that they had or for the lunch they had at those conferences. There were $73.50 for meals that were not adequately documented. Those were meals during the course of the International Association of Marine Investigators Conference, and there was not adequate documentation as to why he was eating those meals. And then there was $25.24 in mileage that was not properly documented. It was in and around mileage during this conference in Portland, and it was not documented as to where he was traveling to obtain those miles. There was an instance of we do a training conference, two weeks of training for new Marine officers that are going to be working on behalf of the Marine Board. The conference was originally going to be in Jackson County at a cost of about $35,000 for hotels. The director made the decision that he thought that would be too expensive in Jackson County. So in looking for a cheaper alternative, they found a youth camp that was in Lincoln City on Devil's Lake, which was at less cost. However, when they went to the camp after they had entered into the contract, they determined that the rooms that were there were not adequate for the students and the instructors, so they ended up having to use hotels in Lincoln City in addition to using the youth camp for that training, which ended up costing $61,000 instead of the anticipated $35,000 had they utilized the facilities in Jackson County. There were six of 31 law enforcement contracts that had the program manager's or had the director's signature but not the program manager's signature. That's the customary way that we approve the contracts is the program manager reviews them, then the director signs off on those. When staff are reimbursed for meals on non-overnight travel, those meals are taxable under IRS regulations. There was direction given to staff that even though they were being reimbursed for meals while in non-travel status, that those meals were to be coded as non-taxable instead of taxable versus in accordance with the IRS regulations. And then there was a six-month period in which the former director utilized his own vehicle on agency business instead of the state vehicles that we have available at the Marine Board, which could have saved the state $1,467. The audit also noted some improper procedures for the change of director. Under DAS policy, you can only retain the director for 30 days. The director was retained for 60 days. The director's signature authority was not removed until March 2010, even though he left at the end of January. And the former director's temporary employment was incorrectly entered. I will point out, however, that the board did contact the Attorney General's office to get guidance on how to do this, and were given guidance by the Attorney General's office on how to hire back the previous director, but there seems to be some confusion as to what was appropriate per DAS policy. So these are the concerns that I put together as the new director coming in, the four areas that I felt were concerns that we needed to address. The first was that there is no board training. The board members that come in begin their time as a board member and do not receive training as to what their responsibilities are, as to what state policies are, and how they're supposed to work with the governor's office and with the staff at the Marine Board. I will, however, point out that most of the things that are contained in this audit are state policy related, and it's quite doubtful that a board member would have that level of knowledge to be able to know that certain state policies were in violation. However, there are some things that you would go over as far as travel and things that they would want to be aware of so that they don't violate state policy as they do their business. There's also no audit mechanism. There were 15 years between the last time the Marine Board had an audit. That makes it very difficult for board members to know what is going on within the agency if they don't have that technical knowledge to be able to look at the books and know if there's something that does not appear correct. Senator Dingfelter and I talked quite extensively about this, that at small agencies we don't have an internal audits function, and so unless somebody comes such as this where there's a change of director, there's not going to be an audit conducted of the agency. The third item which was of concern is that staff did not receive training on small purchases, yet they had the SPOTS cards and were involved in numerous small purchases. And staff were not receiving guidance from Department of Administrative Services or DOJ for the procurement process or disposal of assets. The Secretary of State's office had a number of areas that they asked us to take action on, so I will go through those and explain where we are at the Marine Board. The first is to establish effective management controls and build a culture of integrity from leadership down through every level of the organization. Really, that starts at the top. That's something where it's important to set expectations, train people in what is appropriate, and ensure that you have appropriate policies that people are utilizing. First thing we did in July, having an idea, I met with all staff members when I first started and had a pretty good idea of what some of the concerns were that staff had. So we scheduled training immediately with Department of Administrative Services on small purchasing. So they came to the Marine Board, and everybody that has small purchasing authority or have SPOTS cards attended 2 days of training where we learned what the rules are for the state and what the things are that we should be doing to ensure that we are following those policies. Staff that have additional responsibilities go through additional training, more in-depth contracting training in particular. Those that are dealing with federal grants go through more in-depth federal grant training. We're doing some training coming up this spring with U.S. Fish in working through their grants, and there is some training this fall with U.S. Coast Guard on ensuring how to work through their grants as well. The Marine Board does have a trained grants coordinator. That is a position that we have, and that individual has attended a large amount of training. However, not all of the grants were going through this person. All of the grants now go through this person, or all of the contracts now go through this person. I don't sign any contracts until they assure me that they've reviewed them and that they are in accordance with state policy. Anytime we update or put new language in any Marine Board contracts, we send that through the Attorney General's office to ensure that they are confident in the language that we're putting in those contracts. All expenditure authority has been clearly granted by letter from me to all of my managers so they know exactly how much they can spend in what areas. Second area that they brought up is to build a system of accountability that ensures all board members and employees understand the expectations for good stewardship of public resources. We will begin offering new board member training. We have two board members that will be leaving the board this summer, and at that time we will be conducting training for the new board members as well as the current board members. Develop comprehensive internal policies and procedures for board employees to use as guidance in properly carrying out the operations of the agency in accordance with state requirements. We have reviewed the DAS policies that apply to the Marine Board. We've adopted 77 human resources DAS policies and 51 financial policies. And we've currently written or updated three Marine Board policies, and we have six Marine Board policies, and we have three more that we're currently reviewing. Every employee must sign, review and sign that they understand and will adhere to the policies. And we've already started this implementation, but it is ongoing. Appropriately accounting for assets, including assets returned from counties. We are currently in the process of procuring patrol boats for 9 of the counties that we work with. We have worked with Department of Administrative Services and the Attorney General's Office throughout this process to ensure that we are purchasing those boats appropriately, as well as disposing of the old boats appropriately. And so we have a lot of documentation that supports the process that we're using. We also changed a management position to a coordinator position. This gives us 2 coordinators, which will have oversight of the Marine program. One coordinator specifically who works with the boats, the boat inventory, will keep track of the state of repair of the boats, replacement of the boats, and ensure that we are abiding by state policy and how we deal with those boats. Another recommendation was consistent separation of access to check stock from the responsibility for reconciliation, documenting of all checks written, and proper review of checks and supporting documentation. And we have made changes within the business services section to ensure that these remain separate. We have also hired a new business services manager who will begin in March. Certainly, as that person comes on board, they're going to identify some additional things that they would like to have changed or additional policies that they would like to put into place to ensure accountability within that section. Adequate documentation and approval of spots card purchases, adequate separation of spots card oversight responsibilities, and verification that purchases are only made by authorized cardholders. These come back to not having training for those that have the spots card. The training was completed in July. We do have ongoing oversight to make sure that folks are adhering to the training that they took. Monitoring of travel card program. I did relay to staff that do have the travel cards. We don't have many staff left that have travel cards, what the requirements are for them because they have been issued those travel cards and they can only use them in travel status. Submittal and retention of adequate travel documentation was an issue that came up, and correct calculation of travel reimbursements as prescribed by state policy. The business services staff will not pay claims unless they are properly documented. They will also ensure proper calculations of per diems that are made. And this has been effective and is ongoing. They noted that reviewing travel reimbursements noted in this report and seeking recovery of overpayments is appropriate. We have worked with Department of Administrative Services on that and for those payments that made financial sense to recuperate, we did so. Resolving taxable meal reimbursements, that has been completed, as well as resolving the former director's incorrect payroll coding. As a follow-up, the Secretary of State's office will request an update 1 year after completion of their audit from us by letter explaining what we have accomplished since their audit. They will make a determination at that time if they will be coming back to conduct a follow-up audit. We've contacted the Secretary of State's office to find out if it's something that agencies can request audits from them to have them come in periodically. That is not something that the Secretary of State's office does. However, they will do paper reviews for you, come in and do financial reviews to assist. But we are looking at the possibility of working with some larger state agencies to utilize their internal audits division at cost. We would pay for that to have them come in and provide those audits, and those would be provided to the board, so the board would have that necessary oversight of what the director is doing with the department. And that completes my presentation.
Okay, thank you. And did you want to add anything before I allow the committee to ask questions about the board response?
Chair,
I know that you're a fairly new board member.
Yes, Chair Dingfelter, just to say that since Director Bruin's taken over, he has made every attempt to keep the board very aware of what's been going on with the audit and the steps that he's taken to try to make changes, and has communicated with us more. We have now work sessions before our board meetings where we can get down into a little bit more detail on a lot of issues that we didn't have before. So there is attempts being made to rectify the situation and move it forward in a positive direction.
And Senator Przanski, I think you had a question. Yeah.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's really more of a comment. Scott, I want to thank you for stepping up and doing what you're doing. I know it cannot be easy moving into that type of position under the cloud that was there. I also want to make sure it's on the record that this was an audit that was done by the Secretary of State's Audit Division. That was one that is done periodically, and this is more for the new members when they will go into agencies and actually will be ones that will check to see whether or not things are running as they are appropriately. And so it's something that we have used with other agencies, and based on their findings and your action plan, again, I commend you for doing what you're doing and bring forward, and it sounds like the board is now feeling maybe better situated than they were in the past, and also hopefully the staff is also more informed as to the do's and the don'ts. So thank you.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Bruin, you know, actually, I had my head down when they said Scott Bruin was coming forward, and I go, wait a minute.
Different one.
Yeah, he's not in politics anymore. So you are now the new director of the Oregon State Marine Board.
Yes, Senator.
Is that correct? Mm-hmm. If someone down the line, the ladder of responsibility, does something financially inappropriate, how quickly would you know about it?
Chair Dingfelter, Senator Olson, I would know about it as soon as it was noted by the accounting staff. And we have had a couple of things that they have brought forward to me where they have had concerns, and we have dealt with those issues, and they've been brought forward same day to me.
Follow up.
These
issues that you have mentioned, were they brought forward to the previous director, or are these a long, ongoing situation?
Chair Dingfelter, Senator Olson, I don't have an answer to that. I don't know what was brought forward and what was not.
Follow up. The reason I'm asking the question is there obviously was some overruns and some problems in this situation here, and I guess basically, who has the oversight? Would it be the board?
Chair Dingfelter, Senator Olson, at this point, I have not been through the training, and when I was appointed to the board, the assumption that I had was that we're a rulemaking body and a policy board, and that the day-to-day operations of the Marine Board was really in the director's hands. And I understand the board has a fiduciary responsibility there, but at that level of day-to-day issues, I was not aware of the goings-on at that.
Mr. Carroll, you've been on the board since June 2009, and you're finally getting training now.
Correct. We are scheduled, as Director Bruin had mentioned.
So, follow up?
Yeah.
Bottom line, basically, what I'm getting to is that apparently there was never any inspector general to look over anybody's shoulder to make sure things were done right. So it goes back to, I would ask, who would be responsible for this oversight? And I think, you know, as the note you just sent to me, we need to probably look at doing audits more often to prevent these problems.
Chair Dingfelter, Senator Olson, I think that's a great point. The director is responsible. The director is responsible for all of these oversights and responsible to the board and to the legislature and to the governor's office that we are following state policy. State policy can be a little bit confusing. It doesn't follow what is normally occurs out there in other businesses because we have certain requirements within the state to ensure that we are expending money appropriately and that the taxpayers are their money, and in our case, the boaters, their money is being used appropriately, and that falls to the director to make sure that happens. However, the issue here, and what I think is important, is I think there needs to be somebody that's there to look at what is going on within that agency to make sure that the director is appropriately overseeing the agency and that something isn't happening that shouldn't be, and has that direct link back to the board to say, okay, here's you can sleep well at night knowing things are going well, or here's some things that you should be aware of. And even at the director's level, there's things that get pretty technical, particularly in the business services side, that to have somebody audit it and come back and say, okay, that looks good, is helpful. We just had the Coast Guard here this week auditing our records with our Coast Guard grant, and they briefed me on Wednesday as to how that audit went. It went very well, that we're doing what's anticipated, but it's nice to have an auditor come in and say, you're doing okay, instead of wondering.
One last question.
Okay, and then another follow-up to him
before we go. This is a pretty simple question. Of these offenses, they don't seem, I mean, are the dollar amount is pretty minuscule. Was anyone at the lower level, Marine Board director, not the director, but a manager or anything like that, was anyone terminated over any of these problems?
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Olson, nobody was terminated for these.
Thank you.
And follow-up as far as DAS involvement, and because I do know that you rely on DAS for some of your services. So DAS was not aware of any of these problems?
Chair Dingfelder, I do not believe so.
Okay. And just remind me as far as how my understanding is the only time an audit for smaller agencies, and I sat on the audits committee, but that was 8 years ago, and frankly I can't remember what the threshold is for required audit. So your agency, my understanding is for smaller agencies, it's when there's a change of director.
And Chair Dingfelder, I was surprised that that is how often that audits are conducted at small agencies. I'm not sure if there are other times that they come in, but one hadn't been conducted.
Yeah. I'm sorry.
One hadn't been conducted for 15 years. What caused that audit 15 years ago, it wasn't a change of director. I'm not sure what caused that audit then, but there definitely was a time lag between audits.
Now, I will be following up with the audits division, but thank you. Senator Prasansky.
Yeah, and, Madam Chair, you kind of touched on it. As for Senator Olson, we had at one point a audits committee that was kind of going to do some oversight, and it was existing, but it didn't really materialize into a full-fledged ongoing assignment, and because there's been some discussion as to understanding this is really something from the executive branch, but at the same time, maybe we need to have that cross-check with the legislative branch to what's happening or not happening at the executive branch.
Can I respond? The one thing that I found interesting in being a new senator and looking over the makeup of the state is the only department that has an inspector general is corrections. Mm-hmm. And perhaps we need someone to dig deeper elsewhere. And thank you for your service, too.
Yes,
thank
sir.
You for coming on board in a tough time.
Yes, thank you for thank you for coming back in front of the committee. I know we were supposed to have you last time, and I apologize that we ran short, but look forward to working with you. And I think you're on the right track, certainly we want to make sure that we're moving forward in a positive way. So I know we'll be seeing you some more in Ways and Means.
And Chair Dingfelder, you had also wanted an update on Holgate Channel. Would you like me to go through that a little bit?
If you could give a brief update, and then I think we're going to adjourn in about 5 minutes.
I have a question after that.
Yeah.
And I'll just give you a quick update on Holgate Channel. Is an issue that we've been dealing with for about 18 months at the Marine Board. It was based on a petition to make the channel and I'm speaking in Portland, sorry, up in Portland, Ross Island on the Willamette River. There's a channel to the east side of Ross Island called the Holgate Channel. The main river runs to the west side of Ross Island. We were petitioned to make the channel and the Ross Island Lagoon a slow no-wake zone. The board made the decision that the lagoon would be a slow no-wake zone, but they asked the staff to put a work group together to determine what they could do with the Holgate Channel, what opportunities there might be to come to some sort of resolution without the board having to dictate one way or another, but to have the parties that utilize that channel come together and find some sort of common ground. Through that process, no common ground was reached. the board asked staff to come back with a recommendation. The recommendation that the staff came back with was for a slow no-wake zone. East Island is at the southeast part of the Holgate Channel, and we designated an area north of East Island to become a slow no-wake zone. We held a public hearing on that, and I don't think anybody that showed up at that hearing thought that was a good idea. We are having a special board meeting tonight. The staff has made a recommendation that the southern end of the Holgate Channel be established as a slow no-wake zone. That would allow kayakers, canoeists, and others to access the Ross Island Lagoon via the South Channel. They could come over from Willamette Park and have an uninterrupted area to access the Ross Island Lagoon. So that is what our recommendation is going into this evening. I'm sure it's going to be an interesting discussion as the board weighs which direction to go with that.
Thank you for the update. I will look forward to hearing about so you're actually taking action tonight?
Correct. Yes.
We look forward to hearing about that and appreciate your updates. I think Senator Brzozinski has one more question.
I do. It's actually a different issue, and Scott, I want to wait until we got finished with the audit and stuff. You probably know that there were two young men that were killed outside of Yahats 2 weeks ago.
Yes.
There's been some mention in the papers about what we might be able to do to maybe help prevent that, in the sense of maybe putting life preservers with some type of a rope setting in some of these areas. I don't think this is going to be your jurisdiction. I believe it would be the Coast Guard. But I'm wondering if the Marine Board has ever had anyone approach them regarding that type of perspective of having opportunities, because if you read the reports, it's pretty graphic what the young men that survived, what they attempted to do was basically use their clothes to make a lifeline to reach them, and they weren't successful. So I'm wondering if you could maybe get back with me as to if we wanted to pursue that, if that's something we could do at the state, or is this something I should be taking up with the Coast Guard?
And Chair Dingfelder, Senator Brzozinski, as the Marine Board, our jurisdiction is boats, so it kind of falls out of our jurisdiction. However, anytime somebody drowns, I feel like it's our responsibility to look at what we can do to help with that kind of an incident. And, you know, an issue where you do have a sneaker wave like that and people feel like they're safe, you just aren't. And regardless of putting signs out, right. You know, we had that couple in Newport that got swept off of the jetty a while back. There's just a feeling of safety that does not exist. And I believe there are places where people have put lifelines or a horseshoe type of a saving flotation that's there that they can throw out to people, and that is definitely something that we could look at. I think for the state, it's something that we can do. It's definitely within our jurisdiction to do something like that.
Okay. Well, I appreciate if we could follow up at some point.
Yes, sir.
Understanding that, you know, education is the best, realizing, I mean, it's pretty amazing looking at the stats. I guess they've said that 25 people have been lost this way since 2000, with another 26 that actually went in but were able to get out. And that's pretty high numbers. And I know that you have certain areas on the coast which are very intriguing and, let's say, maybe attractive nuisances where people are more at risk. And so the thought would be maybe in those few places trying to take a little more extra precaution.
Yes, sir.
Thanks.
And you had one last
question. Mr. Bruin, I just want to make a comment on the Holgate Channel because I fish that area quite a bit. Are the folks going to be able to get from the boat ramp across the river safely?
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Olson, that is the difficult part because you do have to go through the main channel to get over there. No petition currently exists to deal with the main channel. I'll say currently exists.
I would only say to the kayakers and the canoeists, good luck.
Okay, any other questions, comments? All right. Thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate both of you coming here today. Now we're going to close the informational meeting on the Marine Board audit, and we'll close the Senate Committee on Environment and Natural Resources for February 17, 2011.